This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Small steps, big possibilities. Nalu Scientific is a local startup that just snared grants from NASA and the U.S. Air Force for its research in microchips. Isar Mostafanazad is the founder of the company that has already snared a $3 million grant from the U.S. Energy Department, and it's exploring where it can push the boundaries of innovation.
Nalu Scientific started about 3 years ago. That's where I started the company, essentially. We design high-speed and advanced microelectronics, also known as integrated circuits. Think about it, the other name for it is microchips. If you open your cell phone or a computer, you see a bunch of computer chips on a printed circuit board that usually do a lot of calculation and computation for you. What we're doing is we're making a special type of microchip for special applications, essentially.
And you folks just got some big grants, federal grants. Talk about that.
Correct. So far, we've been getting federal funding for the work that we do, mainly because the main user for our work is the government labs, federal labs, universities, government research programs that need this technology, but nobody's selling them the technology. So what happens is the government, through this program called the Small Business Innovative Research, foots the bill for R&D, in the hope that we will commercialize the technology and they will be able to buy the finished goods, essentially.
And so tell us about the grant that you just got.
Well, we've been getting multiple of those. So we started with Department of Energy, Office of Science. That was the main user of these microchips. And now the recent one is the NASA project that we got funded. We basically took the microchips that was funded by the Department of Energy and thought of innovative ways to using it for a space application, in this case NASA. And NASA liked the project. We proposed it for a LIDAR project, essentially, for space applications. And they liked it because they didn't have to fund making the microchip, but they could fund getting an application out of it, which would be along the lines of their mission.
So how do you envision, then, this working in a trip to space? That's pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, space is making a comeback right now, and that's mainly due to all the hype and the private money that's in it, too. So government, NASA, for example, has been like the forefront of these types of work. And there's a lot of technologies that come out of it that sit on shelves usually. So if there's a company that could do a little bit of work and maybe a small market, but grab some of that technology and bring it to, you know, end user, other users, you know. So if you think about it, LIDAR is not just used for space, it's used in even self-driving cars, for example. So there's a lot of overlap, that's what I'm saying, in the fundamental side of technology. So yeah, space is making a comeback. There's a big rush. So funding, there's lots of funding usually in this case. And our goal is to really show and demonstrate feasibility for our technology. And then, you know, baby steps, essentially, and then take it to the next level.
So now, do you kind of huddle with the scientists over at the Institute for Astronomy saying, here, this is my idea. How can we make it work to advance your theory on a project?
We've had a lot of chats with them. We talked a lot. We get together for lunch. I mean, our office is right next door to them. We're at the Manoa Innovation Center, so which is right one building over, essentially. So we get together a lot. There is possibility for that relationship to grow, so we're constantly working on that. Not yet. We're not at that level yet. But, yeah, it's in the future. Our microchips could be used for, you know, advanced telescopes, maybe for either Earth-based or, you know, space-based telescopes, essentially, possibly. So it requires a lot of getting together and a lot of whiteboard space so that you can draw things and concepts and then say, oh, maybe using nanotechnology could make this thing 10 times faster or cheaper. Why don't we try it? And then we would get together with them and go after funding, basically, which has been the model that we've been putting together with other scientists at different universities and national labs.
Okay, so this is baby steps, but still significant milestones with these significant funders.
Correct. So we are in the hard sciences, hard tech sciences, basically, space, which means a lot of hardware development, you know. So that's very fund capital intensive. And so our goal, I mean, we have to go back for more money essentially all the time. it's tens of millions of dollars of funding is needed basically to get to somewhere. And that's why we're constantly, you know, looking for innovative ways to solve problems so that we can keep the team funded, basically.
And, you know, we're looking for the best and the brightest minds to take us to the next level. And we've had the recent push for TechForce. As a new company that's growing, you know, what's the situation out there?
That's a very good question. You know, a small company on an island, where do you find your skilled workers? And when I say skilled workers, I'm talking people with PhDs and 5 years of work experience in the field that we are in. So it's beyond, you know, school. It's school, professional, and in the same field that we are in. So it's very advanced skills that we're looking for. What we've done so far is we've been working with the University of Hawaii. So we fund any grant or project that we get from the federal government or other entities, we fund a small group at UH to do some work, which means they get a piece of the pie, essentially, and then they hire graduate students or postdoctoral fellows to do some of the work. And when these people graduate, then essentially they know exactly what we want them to do, so they're very good and compelling job candidates for us. We've had hires from that through this program, so we've had a good pipeline through that. And in fact, some people have graduated from UH, come and work for us, and then got headhunted by bigger companies and moved on, you know. So this has been happening. So that's how we can, you know, manage our workforce.
Yeah, but that, I'm sure that's disappointing when you've got someone that you vested in, and then they get snatched away by bigger salaries, maybe.
Bigger salaries, other opportunities. There are people that are born and raised here. They want to go see something else. Mobility is not a bad thing. I'm an example of that. I'm an immigrant myself. So, but what has happened is these people, it's actually kind of a feather in our cap that they're so good that they get headhunted. But what has happened is these people have moved on to bigger corporations or other places. We kept the relationship. You know, there's still discussions going
there.
On. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And now you have somebody inside a bigger team that you know, knows you, knows how you operate, and there's possibility for a future relationship. So,
well, that's exciting, though.
Exactly.
Looking at it that way.
Yeah.
It's the promise of what could come.
Exactly. Exactly. It's an investment, you know. So we've invested so much, and people see that. So, yeah.
And you just shared with me that you're a new dad. So you understand that, yeah, I mean, this is your baby. You're trying to nurture this company and bring it along.
It is. So when we started in 2016, it was myself. Now we have 10 people full time working on the projects. So yeah, it's really promising to see this come together and grow. And I think we have a lot longer ways to go.
And is there anything that that captures your imagination when you hear the talk about the space exploration and the energy that's being put, you know, toward that?
There's a lot. Yes, there's a lot. It's this inrush of, you know, we just had the 50th anniversary of, you know, moon landing, basically. It's this inrush of things that I used to read when I was a kid in magazines and things like that about the Golden Age and all that stuff. But all the technology that we're developing, we're also thinking about other adjacent markets that it could be used for. We're not just, you know, pushing for space. That's one point that I want to transfer to you, that we are constantly looking for other places it could be used for. And, you know, at the same time, we want to be doing good work, do something that's satisfying for us, because we have engineers that are very curious. They want to solve big problems, and you have to give them big problems to solve. Otherwise,
well, we have plenty of those.
Yeah. Yeah. Then space is one of those. So it's a challenging place. It's your power is limited. Your heat transfer is limited. You have to cram all your microelectronics and sensors in one, you know, tiny space, essentially. And it has to survive a launch environment, maybe possibly reentry to another, you know, atmosphere, essentially. So it's a very, very challenging problem. People say it probably takes us maybe another 10 years to get anything in orbit, even if we develop the tech, even if the tech is working on the bench perfectly fine. All the testing and everything else that it has to go through to get up there is probably another 5 to 10 years, basically. So it's a long ways to go. That's why we're also looking at adjacent markets, essentially, to survive and sustain ourselves.
Okay. And then you mentioned that you're an immigrant. What attracted you to come to Hawaii?
Yeah, exactly. I came here to go to grad school, actually. So I got I had a bachelor's and master's degree back at my home country, and then I got an offer, a full scholarship for a PhD program at the University of Hawaii in the electrical engineering department. And that was 2006 when I came here, and, you know, since then I graduated with my PhD, worked at multiple different startup companies, started my own company, you know, got married, bought a house, things like that. So, yeah.
You're living life. But you're where you want to be, and you're doing the work that you want to do.
I'm definitely doing the work that I want to do. I'm definitely where I want to be. I think Hawaii has a lot of great potential, and it's given me so much, and the least I can do is try to make something work here. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, congratulations on the grants, and thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Mostafanazad has his roots in Persia and has transplanted here in the islands. He is reaching high thanks to the High Tech Development Corporation and the Small Business Innovation Research Matching Grants Program. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we've set our sights on a visionary monarch with his fascination with technology. In the 1870s, the nation was abuzz with talk of electrical energy, and King David Kalakaua was quick to recognize its potential, quicker, in fact, than government leaders anywhere else, including Washington, D.C. During his 1881 world tour, Kalakaua contacted Thomas Edison. 5 years later, a demonstration of electric light at Iolani Palace became a state occasion. Then Princess Liliuokalani and Princess Likelike organized a tea party. The Royal Hawaiian Band played, and thousands watched as Edison's bulbs made the palace incandescent. The event led to the installation of an electrical system on palace grounds, and on November 16, 1886, which was the king's birthday, Iolani Palace became the world's first royal residence to be lit by electricity. Eventually, the kingdom and later the territory would be electrified. We are looking back at the start of its commercialization. That's your backyard quiz for today. Where was Honolulu's very first power plant, and what was its energy source? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you think you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from handcrafted restaurants celebrating the craft of food, drink, and merrymaking at Monkey Pod Kitchen by Merriman on Maui and Oahu, Moku Kitchen on Oahu, and the Beach House on Kauai.
In the past few weeks, we've been hearing a lot about climate change and the young voices that are rising up to take action. Greta Thunberg is just one climate activist throwing the spotlight on changing behavior. Here in the islands, Hawaii Energy has been looking at ways to get the community to adopt energy-saving practices. The Empower Hawaii Project helped about a half a dozen groups to save some $30,000. It's looking for a second round of motivated nonprofits. We sat down with Brian Kalaho last week to talk about that project.
It was really inspired by our marketing director, Shana Doi. She had worked with Habitat for Humanity and their Restore, and we saw the impact that could be made by them reducing their energy bills by doing a lighting project. So we said, we need to do this in a broader format, and how can we involve more nonprofits? So we created this program specifically for nonprofits, and we had our first cohort last year where we had five different participants. And what we did was we walked them through the whole process. One, just to understand how they're using energy, so the awareness piece first. And then we helped them with technical assistance and increased incentives and how to write an RFP, how to evaluate quotes, and help them through the process rather than just saying, here's an incentive, come back to us once the project's complete. Because we knew that nonprofits typically don't have facility managers. They don't have people who are really focused on this. So we knew we had to make it easy.
Guide us to the steps. I mean, you know, how did they achieve these savings?
So what they did first was they had somebody come out and we helped them. We did an audit of the facility to show them where they're, how they're using their lighting and how much energy that they were using. And then we worked with them. We sat down and helped them put together an RFP. And they went out to a couple of the vendors that we work with. We have Clean Energy Allies that do energy projects across the state. A short list of those wanted to help nonprofits out. And so they sent the RFP out to those vendors. The vendors provided their proposals. We helped them through the evaluation of the proposals to understand what they're looking at and how to evaluate what they're seeing. And ultimately, they made the nonprofits would make the selection on who they wanted to work with. That vendor would come in, complete the project, and work with us to get the rebates. And what we did that was special last year, beyond all of that, was we also provided an elevated level of rebates so that then the return on this investment was under 2 years. It made it really attractive for them to move forward.
And so you have just opened up the period then to get a whole new cohort of companies in. And so how is that going?
It's going well so far. We just opened it up on October 1st, and it's kind of combined with October's Energy Awareness Month. And earlier this week was Energy Efficiency Day. So we really put the call out to nonprofits to become more aware about how they're using their energy. We've went out in a number of different means, but I think what's been the most effective so far is the participants who participated last year have been out telling the story of how beneficial it was for them and how easy and the program was made for them. We really focused on trying not to use technical jargon and make it simple for them to understand what we were doing, and it seemed like that worked pretty well.
Is it just as simple as changing the lamps in your lights in your office?
That's one of the places that we start with, and that's where the focus of the cohorts have been. But as you know, in some of these facilities, we work with Children's Discovery Center. So in that case, the lamps are really high up in the ceiling, harder to access. It's not something you can do on your own. In that case, that's why they needed a vendor to come in and do that. But the other part to that was really interesting. We know this, but until you see it in action, I think sometimes we forget. The Children's Discovery Center in particular, they've received so many comments about how well lit and how much nicer it is inside. And so those are some of the non-energy benefits of the project beyond saving money and reducing their energy use.
And you're talking about older buildings. I mean, that's a kind of repurposed incinerator. One of the other groups was the YWCA?
Correct. Right, and that was a historic building, so they had some of their challenges as well as they looked at certain fixtures, especially if you're doing fixture replacements versus just changing out the lamps itself. So we helped them through all of those processes.
And what's maybe the biggest challenge that you folks came across in working with these different groups last year?
I think the biggest challenge was really for them to have enough upfront capital to be able to do the work. So for them, even though we provide rebates, you still need to come up with some of the money upfront. So that meant having to go to their boards, showing what the return would be. And one, if they just had to have the money, first of all, if they didn't have the money, that was a challenge in and of itself. And secondly, to allocate the money to be able to use it for this purpose. So that was the biggest challenge, especially as we are talking to everyone who's participated in the first cohort. They want to do more, but they realize they don't have the budget to do more. So we're trying to work now to find some other financial mechanisms for them to be able to finance the project and maybe pay for it out of savings. But that's probably been the biggest challenge is the upfront cost.
Are there any grants that are available either federally, or on the state level?
We're looking into it. There's a couple of grants that are available for rural. The designation under USDA is rural, so it's not outside of urban Honolulu. Nonprofits that fall into that category would be eligible for some grant funding for energy efficiency.
Were any Neighbor Island nonprofits included in this first go-around?
Not the first go-around, but we are hopeful that we will see a broader set this year.
As far as then criteria, I mean, if there are nonprofits out there that want to participate, are there guidelines they have to meet?
There are. We're looking for, obviously, nonprofits who are motivated to want to take action. So we're looking for nonprofits that are willing to commit some time to the process, because we hold monthly workshops to help educate them and walk them through the process. So there's, we ask for a time commitment of a couple of champions. We also want to make sure that they're empowered enough to be able to make decisions of where their nonprofit is located. So if you own your facility, you're obviously in that position. If you're leasing your facility, just that you have the approval of your landlord to be able to make the changes. So those are probably the two primary requirements that we were looking for, so that people can actually move to implementation.
So the idea of empowering these nonprofits, is this program model after something else on the mainland, or?
No, it was actually a brainchild of our marketing director, who used to work for a nonprofit, and she realized how challenging it is when you look at how much your operating costs are, and how could we funnel more dollars to the mission. And we said, well, why don't we help them? Because part of our responsibility as Hawaii Energy is we want to make sure that everybody is participating in our programs. And oftentimes, those that have better access to capital or better engineering staff that know what to do, they're the ones that are participating in our program. So we decided we need to do better outreach and make sure we bring everyone as a part of this. And that's really where that came from.
Okay, so for this first group that went through it, they produced their bills. But is there something more then that they can do?
There is. So they're looking, they focused on lighting primarily. And now we're looking to see what we can do around their air conditioning loads and other ways that they use energy. Those projects usually take a little bit longer because you have to deal with the entire air conditioning system. They cost a little bit more. So that's why we're stepping it into the next phase, but also part of the cohort, which we've done in the first and we'll do in this second one as well, is we try to teach them about how they're using their energy, because some of the savings can come from just behavioral changes and how you operate a facility, making sure you shut things off on at the end of the day or over the weekend and those types of things. We find that you can save, you know, up to 10%, sometimes usually 5 to 10% on just changing how you use your equipment. Well, beyond operating cost savings, which is huge and important for nonprofits, I think the events of the past few weeks with Greta in particular, raising the awareness around climate change, a lot of people aren't aware that energy efficiency really can help advance our and help us meet our climate goals. There's been studies nationally that have shown if we were to fully embrace and go aggressively towards reducing our energy use, we can get to about half of our climate goal needs. So because a lot of how we produce electricity now is not renewable, just by reducing waste, we can go a long way there. So I like to tell people that story to make sure they see the connection, that they're saving money on your energy bill is important, but there is a real connection to this greater planet and our greater good.
Right. So if you have youngins in your family, start them young, start them to be more aware of whether they're leaving the lights on or leaving the TV blaring or that kind of thing.
Exactly. I mean, the keiki really are our future. And it's funny because I've seen where we've done student workshops and they've come home and they've made a difference at home because the parents will listen to their kids. They won't listen to adults or us.
That was Brian Kealoha, Executive Director of the Hawaii Energy Office, talking about a program to empower nonprofits and help them save money. The first group that took part last year included the Waikiki Health Center, Waimanalo Health Center, the Children's Discovery Center, the YWCA, and Lunalilo Home.
Aloha, this is Jose Fajardo, President and General Manager of Hawaii Public Radio. We successfully concluded our fall fund drive on Friday with over $761,000. We also welcomed 812 new members to our Ohana. And we achieved all of this with 42 fewer hours of fundraising thanks to our sustaining members. A sincere mahalo to everyone who makes HPR possible. Mahalo for your support.
Local GOP leaders are standing firm in their support of President Donald Trump. That is the subject of today's reality check. Honolulu Civil Beat's political and opinion editor, Chad Blair, on the line this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
So, yeah, we've been seeing, you know, quite the headlines in the last week or so. So it was good that you kind of circled back to check to see, you know, where people stand on things.
Right. The impeachment inquiry from the House of Representatives into the president, I mean, it's been the number one story for the last, gosh, I think it's even beyond a week or 10 days, 2 weeks now. And every time I check my Twitter feed, there's a new headline. It's a little hard to keep up with all the news. Right now, it's been announced the Trump administration is going to not cooperate with Nancy Pelosi on their inquiry. We'll see where that goes. But I wanted to check with local Republicans, those that are in positions of authority, on what they think about the impeachment inquiry. And everyone, pretty much, most of them, and I talked to more than a half dozen, said they think it's nonsense. I think it's really a waste of time, that it's phony, that it's fake outrage, that the House should not be spending, and mind you, the House is dominated by Democrats, should not be spending its time trying to impeach President Trump. They think instead it should be focused on Joe Biden and his son and what they were doing in Ukraine. And that was a pretty universal theme from the folks that I spoke to.
I mean, is it a script?
Well, these are some of the very same talking points that you will see when you look at Breitbart News, for example. Some of this is being reflected in Fox. I did ask several people, and this includes Sherlene Ostroff, the party chair, and there were others like Sam Sloan, who was in office, is running again, Gene Ward, a few others. I said, well, what about these reports that there's nothing to the Biden stuff, that there was really no corruption going on, that this is really a red herring, it's a political attack? And they said, well, wait a minute, no, we need to investigate this. They think it's a legitimate line of inquiry and that the president is really only doing his job by pressuring, by his own admission, by the admission of the transcript, to pressure the president of Ukraine to look into the Biden situation. And that came off repeatedly as well. So, I mean, I think what we've seen in this country since 2016 is a clear divide about who you're going to believe, which media are you going to believe, and which party are you going to believe.
I know some folks were probably shocked to find out about the Ukraine call, and then to have his comments about China. You know, that kind of probably make people gulp again.
And by the way, China has officially said they're not going to look into the Biden situation. I did hear this as well, though, and you're hearing this echoed by national Republicans, that, hey, the Mueller report didn't work. Yes, it did not find collusion with Russia and Trump, but it did find at least 10 examples of possible obstruction. But it didn't seem to stick, as we all know. It just didn't quite stay in the public's mind. And so what Democrats are trying to do, according to the Republicans, is they're just trying to get rid of Trump because they're afraid of facing him for re-election in 2020. They won't have a candidate who can beat him, so they got to get rid of him some other way. Impeachment is that other way.
Right, but we've also seen how the donations have been pouring in for the Trump campaign.
Right, it's the third quarter of reports. And so, you know, Sanders and Biden and Warren are still leading the pack. Biden, not as much. His fundraising dropped a bit. But Trump, more than each candidate in the Democratic field, in fact, you could combine several of the Democrats together, and their campaign fundraising total would not exceed President Trump. The impeachment inquiry is being used by the Trump campaign, perhaps wisely on their part, to raise money on behalf of the president's reelection.
And then since the Ukraine and the China headlines, we now have this new thing with the U.S. possibly pulling out of Syria. And in that case, though, you've got some Republicans and aren't real happy about the president's comments and tweets.
That's correct. Even Mitch McConnell, a Senate majority leader, Lindsey Graham, a strong supporter of the president in the Senate, very upset with his decision, which appears to be in flux right now, but essentially saying we're going to withdraw U.S. troops from northern Syria. This is coming as Turkey is indicating that they will have a military offense in the region. I should again caveat this by saying, well, that was an hour ago or that was yesterday. What's going to be the news now? But for a moment, that did bump the impeachment matter off the top of the news. But now with this new refusal to cooperate the White House with the House, it's back in the news again. And we're seeing it dominate. And one wonders where this is going to go, how much further we're going to be keep talking about this. Because think about it, the presidential election, 13 months away only.
Yeah. And I'm sure after you reached out to all these folks, That was probably before the headlines about Turkey. But
right, I did,
there's always
I didn't
something
even,
going on.
I didn't even bother asking about that. I just stuck with the impeachment inquiry, and we'll see. But bottom line, the local leaders of the Republican Party sticking with the president think he will be reelected.
All right. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat's political and opinion editor, Chad Blair, with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Friends of the Waikiki Aquarium's Distinguished Lecture Series. Dr. Tim Trikas discusses how bioacoustic research of fish aids in coral reef monitoring, October 17th at Tenney Theater.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, vaping deaths and injuries are getting the attention of people who use the products. But for those who want to quit, kicking the habit isn't so easy. What works? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following the world.
We received several emails and calls in response to recent stories on The Conversation. Let's start off with an email responding to an interview with Hilton Rathel of the Healthcare Association of Hawaii. He talked about a shortage in trained professional healthcare workers. I enjoyed listening to your guest today. He had a lot of interesting ideas, but failed to recognize the number one issue. The solution is salary. Pay people what they make on the mainland, and you don't have to worry about people leaving or not coming back. Spending millions or billions of dollars on a physical therapy facility is not going to keep people here. Just pay people more. Hilton's arguments that the salaries are above minimum wage, it's not very persuasive. And last week, we talked to Neil Hitch from the Mission Houses Museum, which commemorated the 200th anniversary of the first congregational mission to Hawaii with theater performances, panel discussions, and cultural events in New England. One listener was touched.
Hi, this is Chris. I live here on Oahu and was very moved by the story about Opakaya. And just to say that it was personally touching because our family's from Cornwall, Connecticut, and I was at a performance, one of my daughter's performances, and saw his portrait and that he was buried in Cornwall. So it sort of comes full circle. And I can tell you, Cornwall is a very special place. Hawaii, obviously, is a very special place. So I think there's good synergy there. And so I'm really thrilled about hearing the touring that's going on, and bravo for everyone involved.
And with our partners at the University of Hawaii Center for Oral History, we heard stories from lay sellers and invoked fond memories. Anita Manning wrote, in the 1970s, Joyce Davis taught lay making through the Bishop Museum's education program. She recruited her students, including me, one year to help her with making horse lay for the Kamehameha Day Parade. They were huge and heavy, and it was done very late at night in a hotel basement. To avoid parking challenges, I biked from Bishop Museum to Waikiki and back. It's too late to ticket me now, but I biked back in the wee hours of the morning along Vineyard and didn't stop for red lights. Aloha. And back in August, after a call-in show featuring Native voices about Mauna Kea, we got this. I listened to the subject program. Can I have the 51 minutes and 21 seconds back? Really, dead air would have been more informative. That was from Joel Thompson, a sustaining member, but who was reconsidering that status. And all I can say is, Joel, touche, and we hope you remain a member. Thanks for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217. For today's backyard quiz, we remember the first flip of the switch to illuminate the night at Iolani Palace. It had everything to do with the visionary monarch, King David Kalakaua. His fascination with modern technology led to an 1881 face-to-face meeting with Thomas Edison and the incandescent spectacle at the palace 4 years before the bulbs appeared at the White House or anywhere in California. It was a memorable Honolulu event in 1886, and 2 years later, the first electric lights were seen on the city streets. Princess Kaʻiulani, the king's niece, threw that switch. But this morning, we asked you about their power source, Hawaii's first electricity plant. It actually came online on March 23, 1888. Water-driven turbines in Nuuanu Stream supplied the energy and so gave its name to the Nuuanu Power Plant. And Ryan Hurley of Honolulu got it right. Congrats to you. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Adaptation. That's the theme of a conference being held next week by the Agricultural Leadership Foundation of Hawaii. More than 500 people are expected to attend the two-day event at the Convention Center. It will feature speakers from as far away from New Zealand and Maryland. This year's event will focus on opportunities in the industry, like incorporating clean energy and advocating for more women farmers. There's also a special focus on students and preparing them for leadership roles in ag. Dana Sato is Oahu's Director of Asset Management at Kamehameha Schools, and her team manages the landowners' ag, residential, and conservation lands across the state. She helped develop a student track for this year's leadership conference. She sat down with our newest producer, Jason Ubai, to talk about the challenges ahead.
This is really one of the main events for the gathering of thinkers and farmers and everyone else involved in ag in one single kind of spot. And I mean, there are other conferences you hear, like the Hawaii Farm Bureau has a conference. Theirs is coming up at the end of October. This 2019 Adaptation conference is scheduled for October 15th and 16th at the Hawaii Convention Center. It's different, though, than the others because it provides you workshops. It's focused on how to make agriculture a much more viable and sustainable industry like it was in the past. But the past, like a far past when you think about it, right?
Right.
We went from being a 100% sustainable island units and into plantation, which really changed things a bit. Still agriculture, but quite different than independent farmers. And then when we have hundreds of thousands of acres coming back from plantations, now we need to find farmers.
Yep.
And that's actually pretty tough to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and I know there's a focus on students. Can you tell me a bit more about that, what they're going to be doing at the conference and how you expect, how's the industry trying to promote farming as a career to have in the future?
Well, just as I mentioned that during the days of the plantation, people worked for the plantation, so they stopped actually farming. Whereas before we had all of these small family farms that operated. So during the time frame that happened at over 100 years, we now are at a point that we need to literally grow farmers.
Yep.
And when we talk to folks, when you look nationally as well as locally, farmers are averaging about 62 and older in age. And the next generation, and we see it at Kamehameha Schools with many of our ag leases, is the second generation doesn't really want to get their hands dirty. And so the generational issue is really a key issue for us. And so trying to tap in on the youth level is so super important for us to do. And so in 2017, which was the last state ag conference, we had a youth program there, and it was such a success. And so for this 2019, we also have a youth program. And with this youth program, it's a little different than we did the last time. And this one is really focusing on trying to bring ag to a level that the kids will understand. And let me give you an example of that. So there's three of us over at Kamehameha Schools that decided that we wanted to do a youth session within this youth program. And we wanted to give these high school students, and whether associated with the Future Farmers of America or not, the opportunity to do a vision for ag, for Hawaii, basically the Hawaii food system for the state of Hawaii, and how they could first understand what the system is about, then notice what the gaps are, and then create a vision going out to 2030 to fill in those gaps. So we brought in two Future Farmers of America advisors, and they brought in three high school kids, and we excitingly presented what we thought was going to be so super exciting for them. And they so gently and kindly, because these kids are so well-mannered, said, "Oh, that sounds interesting. but maybe if we could sort of narrow the topic down so it's something we can relate to." So to me, you know, to us three that were involved in that, it basically boiled down to, "Oh, Auntie, you guys are like super boring." And that's like way over our heads. So why don't we talk about something that we can really understand? And so that's why the program is actually focused on school lunches, because it's taking the kids from a farmer and what it takes for that sweet potato or that ulu to make it through the entire food system so that it ends up on your school plate. And so we have industry experts that are coming in to talk about the opportunities and the gaps with regard to that. We actually have two, one currently the president of the Future Farmers of America for the state. He's going to come and speak and talk about food systems. But we also have a student who just graduated from Mililani High School. Her name is China Chun. And China's going to explain to the students, when I was a senior at Mililani High School this past year, the Aina Pono program was operated there. We had the opportunity to eat scratch-cooked local produce lunches. And wow, how much better those were from the stuff that we're having to eat today based on our current federal regulations and et cetera. So that was a topic that the kids kind of lit up on because they could relate to it. And so the youth program is going to go through a couple of different phases. So the first day we're going to spend with them to just explain this whole process with these speakers. And then the second half of that day, we're going to spend allowing them to do the visioning. And then they're going to present their visions to their peers. And the next day, we're going to have them present their visions to the entire conference. Because day two is the keynote speakers is about the next generation. And so we're having those kids actually do the presentations and then spend a day gathering comments from the others that are attending the conference. And then the later half of the second day, we have a session that's focused on careers in ag. A lot of people, and I say that very broadly because a lot of people really think when we talk about ag, we're only talking about farmers. But when you're talking about ag, you're talking about scientists. You're talking about soil experts. You're talking about ranchers. It's such a broad area. You're talking about accountants, you know, people that can do business. It's not just about farming. And we wanted the kids to be able to understand that. And then the last part of it is to bring in students that are currently involved in the FFA program and to explain why the things that they do are important and how that can help students better understand not only agriculture but also about becoming a leader. At the end of the day for this youth conference, our ultimate goal is that the kids will take the information that they learn and they can, by their individual chapters, go to talk to their legislators and advocate for positions. Go to their spring statewide conference that they have for the FFA and start talking about these visions and develop them. Quite honestly, our youth is really an untapped group of people. These kids here that we have, they're smart. They just need to be able to understand what the issues are, be moved by it, which is what we hope this conference will do for them. And then that will just activate the fire within them. And there's lots of adult leaders out there that are willing to help them along with that.
I know that part where you were saying they have to present to them. That sounds a little nerve-wracking, but it's something that these young people have some great ideas and probably, you know, looking at it from a different lens.
today's kids are much different than you're a lot younger than I am, Jason. But certainly, they're learning how to do PowerPoints. They're learning how to do other forms of presentations. Even though there is a lot of kids that are wrapped into social media and can kind of isolate themselves, there are still a number of these kids that really have it within them to be great leaders. And I know that the FFA program is about that, is about leadership. The Ag Leadership Foundation of Hawaii is all about leadership. Yeah. So when we host these conferences, it's about leadership. Leadership is key, and we really believe that our youth today, they're a much stronger, much more active group of people than they have in the past.
And we're looking at the students that come to this will be leaders in agriculture and not, as you were saying, how we move from when they open plantations that, you know, you're a hired worker. This is sole proprietor or, you know, joining, having your own farm or being a scientist or a soil scientist and accountants and different things as part of the agricultural team, right?
Yeah. So When we talk about adaptation, we're really talking about creating a sustainable agricultural industry where you provide for jobs so people will have jobs they can stay home, right, and work. That there's different, and a job doesn't mean that you have to be the only one in the ground. You jobs at all kinds of levels, management levels and otherwise. That it provides for a lifestyle that allows you to have a family and to be able to support your family, right? So a lot of just plus things that can come along with that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just circle back with the school lunches. Can you tell me a bit more about what's the state of the school lunches now versus what I'm assuming we want to get to where there's more local food on your plate? For our students.
Yeah, so one of the first levels you have to think about is that there was a time before when our lunches were cooked from scratch. But the time today is our lunches are not cooked from scratch. So it becomes, let me give you an example that was just brought to my attention just a week or so ago. Is you look at someone who's currently working as a janitor. They see at their school that there's a position open in the cafeteria. They apply for that position because it's a pay grade or pay level adjustment. And so it's a great move for them. So it's not as if they're moving there because they have the knife skills, they have the cooking skills. It's a pay level adjustment. So they're not doing that kind of cooking where in the past they used to do that type of cooking. I'm not really positive as to why that change happened, except to have like little inklings of it. Inklings of it is that measurement of nutrition. So is ketchup considered a condiment or is that considered a vegetable? Believe it or not, that's a good question. You should look it up and you'll be surprised by the answer when you look at it from a school nutritional thing.
I feel like it's a vegetable, but it also, I mean, from like a data standpoint, but you know, you ask anyone and not many people would consider ketchup
But there are standards, right, that the schools have to meet. And so you look at certain things like ulu, that's a carb. Now you can't have rice. Whereas we kind of look at ulu as being kind of a little bit of a vegetable, a little bit of this. And so it really is that our way of eating is quite different than the national way. And then just to meet what the national requirements are makes it much easier for you to open a can or to heat it up in a microwave than it is to start from scratch cooking. It's a much more difficult process. The change that needs to take place is a significant change. But it's not as if cafeterias can't do it because they have run at least two pilot programs on that that were totally successful. But it's understanding all the regulations in between that make it difficult to get from that beginning to the end.
That was Dina Sato, Asset Manager for Kamehameha Schools. The Hawaii Agriculture Conference will be held October 15th and 16th at the Hawaii Convention Center. Discounted rates are available for students. More information can be found on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thank you.
on the next Fresh Air, the whistleblower who exposed Cambridge Analytica's role in the 2016 presidential election. The company harvested personal data from tens of millions of Facebook users and used it to target people susceptible to disinformation and conspiracy theories. Wiley had been the research director at the company. Now he's written a new book. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, following On Point.
That is it for today. Up tomorrow, Bill Dorman talks about growing tensions between Hong Kong and China. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. Call 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them on The Conversation page. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.